McMahon lost her first bid for U.S. Senate in 2010 and has spent more than $60 million of her own money in the past 3 years. On the Democratic side, Congressman Chris Murphy is favored to win his party's nomination in the Senate race against former Secretary of the State Susan Bicewitz. There is also a Democratic and Republican primary in the state's 5th congressional district. For NPR News, I'm Diane Orson in New Haven.
Funeral services are being held this morning in New York for Marvin Hamlisch. The award-winning music composer, songwriter, and arranger died last week in Los Angeles at the age of 68. His work on Broadway and Hollywood won him 3 Oscars, 4 Grammys, and a Tony. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their 2 local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
In this hour, we'll explore the origins of the financial crisis of 2008, and our guest is Gretchen Morgenson. She is a business reporter, and she writes the Fair Game column in the Sunday business section of the New York Times, where she also serves as assistant business and financial editor. She's the co-author of a book that we'll be talking about. She wrote the book along with Joshua Rosner, and the title of the book is Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's published by Times Books. And the book looks at what the authors identify as a big problem here, the fact that the financial institutions that had so much trouble and the people that are charged with regulating and overseeing them were just too close. And in a sense, when you look at how people have moved back and forth between the two sides, essentially they are the same people. And the book also concentrates particularly on the role in the financial collapse that was played by Fannie Mae and also the Federal Reserve. And Ms. Morgenson, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
And I guess it's funny, you know, in talking about this, I've said things like we're going to look back to this crisis, and I guess one has to acknowledge in the fact that this crisis, it's not really over, or at least in the sense that we're still dealing with the implications of what happened.
We absolutely are, David. I mean, unemployment, of course, over 9%. Foreclosures continuing to be a problem. Delinquency rates high. So, you know, we really, really are still in the thick of it. And that's why Josh Rosner and I decided that we really wanted to help explain this to people, because it continues to be a problem. It continues to harm people, hurt homes, hurt families. We really wanted to be able to give them sort of a roadmap of how this took place.
Yeah, and I think we ought to tip the hat to him, particularly because he was somebody who is now pointed out as somebody who really rather early on, before other people were, was pointing to some of the problems that we were seeing, like vastly overvalued housing and problems with these bundled bad mortgages. And so he really was one of the first people to sort of stand up and say, hey, look, we got a serious problem here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe the place to start, as I think often you do when you're talking about this, is really to go back, to go back some time, and to go back, in fact, to the mid-90s. This was when President Bill Clinton was president, and his administration decided that it would be a good thing to promote home ownership.
Yes.
And the idea was to forge this partnership between these quasi-governmental agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and private industry, the bankers and lenders and so forth. The idea is we get these people to work together, we can make it possible for people to have mortgages, borrow the money, buy the homes, and achieve this hallmark of the American dream, to have a home. And it seems like actually for a little while, maybe that actually worked okay.
Well, for a little while it did work. Now, the whole premise, I guess, was that home ownership rates had been stagnant. You know, coming out of the S&L crisis and the recession of the early 90s, I think that the president was worried about this sort of declining home ownership rate. So he decided to, you know, get everybody together, private sector, public sector, Fannie Mae, and really do a push for home ownership under the idea that, you know, owning your home creates stable neighborhoods, it creates good schools, you know, it's all a benefit, all to the good. But you see, what ended up happening was this was a very noble idea, but in the execution, it became really almost perverted, because what happened was, in order to increase the rates of home ownership to include first-time home buyers, minorities, immigrants, the private sector really started to create loans that were increasingly difficult to pay back, increasingly expensive to these people, and increasingly toxic, frankly. And so it really was not about home ownership. It was about digging yourself into debt with these very, very pernicious loans.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it also wasn't helped that then perhaps also, by the same token, there were middle-class people who started to look at their homes not just as a place to live, but also as an investment.
Absolutely.
And it became increasingly attractive. Offers would come for home equity loans.
Mm-hmm.
And banks would say, look at the great value you have in this place. We're going to loan you some money so you can take that money and make home improvements or pay off your bills or go on vacation or do whatever you want. And after all, don't we all know that? See, the implicit thing was, after all, don't we all know that the value of real estate just is always going to keep going up? It can't possibly go down. So this is a no-risk proposition.
Excellent point to make, David, because that is where we really perverted the traditional idea of home ownership. You know, in the old days, you took out a mortgage, you looked at your banker in the eye, he or she looked at you in the eye and decided whether you were money good, gave you the loan if he thought you were, and then you paid it down over time. You had a mortgage burning party at the end of the line, and you owned the house free and clear, and you could pass it on to your children or your grandchildren. That was the best sort of forced savings account going in the United States. Well, when they created these home equity loans and these second mortgages that you could take out on your home, it really perverted that process, allowing you to use it as a piggy bank. But now that prices are falling, now that real estate has collapsed, people have bigger mortgages than the value of the asset that they have underlying them.
Yeah.
So it really perverted the idea of home ownership, which had traditionally been a huge source of savings in America.
Well, and also, I know there certainly was a point when I think people were really starting to raise questions about some of the crazy instruments that were available to make it possible for people to buy a home. There were interest-only mortgages, and there were adjustable-rate mortgages that might initially have offered a very attractive and affordable rate, but then a couple of years down the line, a new and much higher rate would come slamming in there, which got a lot of people into a lot of trouble. And then, of course, there was the problem that we've seen with people who got loans that probably should not have, and because the lenders did not thoroughly vet those people. They might have actually engaged in some fraud, and all of that all bound up together. You have to say, now, was there someone or some entity whose job it was to, in a sense, look over the shoulder of these lenders and say, either what you're doing is illegal, or what you're doing is unethical, or what you're doing is unadvisable? Was there anybody whose job it was to do that?
Absolutely. Well, we do have a regulatory structure in this country, whether it's the Federal Reserve, which oversees the major banks across the country, or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or the Office of Thrift Supervision. It is absolutely something that regulators should have been on top of and were not. Now, you know, you make a very good point about these lenders, you know, coming up with these crazy loans. Well, don't forget that a really key part of this puzzle was that most of these lenders sold off the loans to Wall Street, who then packaged them into securities to sell to investors. And so they had no real incentive to make sure that the loan would be repaid. All they cared about was making the fees on the loans. And so this, again, perverted the process, which had worked so well for so long, which was to do the due diligence that you needed as a banker on a loan to make sure that it would get repaid. That all went out the window when you could just package the loans, sell them to somebody else, and wash your hands of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that there always was, or at least had been for a long time, a secondary market for mortgages.
Yes.
And that actually, the idea there seems on the face of it to be a good one, the idea being that you're a bank, you lend somebody the money to buy a home, then you're holding the home. Well, you don't really want the house, you don't really want the mortgage. What you would like to do is to be able to loan out more money. So somebody else will come along and say, okay, I'll buy that mortgage from you. I'll give you some more money. You can then lend that out again, and somebody else can go and buy a house. Now, that sounds like, actually, on the face of it, pretty good. The problem, though, is that indeed, if that initial loan is any risk attached to that initial loan, you, as the initial lender, get to hand that off to somebody else, which in fact is what happened. Now, if you're an unscrupulous person, well, then that works to your advantage. Did somehow the way that the secondary mortgage market was supposed to function, did that actually change somehow?
Well, it didn't. It just got much, much bigger. And you had a scenario where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who guaranteed many of these mortgages if they were of a certain size, started to relax their own parameters, their own standards for what they would accept as far as what the characteristics of the loan would be. And so this is why Fannie Mae is so important in this story, because they were sort of the primary mover in automating underwriting, which sort of sped up the process and took out some of the care and prudence that was involved in lending. And so they would set the tone for the entire industry, for the entire home loan market, with every move they made. And so as they moved down the spectrum, i.e. accepted more questionable loans, more dubious loans, then it became sort of a okay for the rest of the market. It was almost like a welcome mat was put out for the rest of the market to create those kinds of loans, because everybody knew that Fannie Mae would guarantee them.
Mm. So was that just a matter of people thought that these kinds of loans were okay because in a sense Fannie Mae had given it its blessing, or was it that the even though on the face of it, these are supposed to be independent entities, people really knew that at the end of the day, if things went bad, it wasn't Fannie Mae that was really on the hook. It was the government that was on the hook, and that the government would indeed be the lender of last resort, or the backstop of last resort.
Absolutely. I think both are accurate. Both statements are accurate. I mean, I think that people felt that the imprimatur of Fannie Mae was a very important one. It was a government-sponsored enterprise. It carried great weight with investors, particularly with investors around the world. Looked at it almost as a government, substitute, a United States Treasury substitute. So yeah, that was a real benefit that the companies had, and of course it allowed them to raise money more cheaply than an investment bank or a commercial bank could do in the public markets, because investors perceived that these companies were special, they were different, they were government sponsored and would not be allowed to fail. Well, now we saw what happened in Labor Day weekend of September of 2008, and that is that they were not allowed to fail. And now the taxpayer is on the hook.
Well, I have some callers I want to get to. I promise these people in just a moment I'll get to them. And some of these things I'm sure we'll be coming back to. But let me just ask one other question at this point, because one of the things that I think that you really have pointed out in this book is that to date, no one really has been held accountable for what happened here, which then, though, does lead to the question, well, were laws broken here? Are there people who should end up going to jail?
Well, I always couch my answer to this question with the idea that I am not a lawyer and I am not a prosecutor, and I do not have to make cases for a living, and those are very difficult to make, and I do not take away anything from the people who are able to make them. However, I think it is a view held by many across the nation that a debacle this large that involves trillions of dollars of losses, that involves losses of jobs, that involves losses of homes, really cannot be nobody's fault. There really do have to be some people held accountable here, or the view is going to spread that there are two sets of rules in America. One for the powerful, politically connected institutions, and the other for Main Street, for every man, for the people who are in the trenches trying to feed their families. And I think that that's not what America is all about. And the idea that that philosophy could spread, I think, is extremely damaging and troubling right now.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Gretchen Morgenson. She writes about business for the New York Times. She's the assistant business and financial editor. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for reporting on Wall Street. She is the co-author, along with Josh Rosner, of the recent book Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. That's a subtitle. It's published by Times Books. And as I mentioned, it's about the financial crisis of 2008, looking at one big problem that they identify, and that is the very close, probably too close, relations between financial institutions and the people who run them on the one hand and the people who regulate them on the other. And particularly, they concentrate in the book on the role that's played by Fannie Mae. Questions are welcome, and we have several. Again, folks will help us by trying to be brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. And we'll start out with someone who is in Charleston and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It's going to be tough to be brief. You've already touched
on so many
topics.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
But quickly, I guess my main question is I'd like the author to comment on the contribution that the Community Reinvestment Act played in this. I know bankers in particular will talk about saying, well, we were almost forced to make loans to people who couldn't pay us back, and we knew that because of the CRA. And I'm just... I've always doubted that argument, but I'd like to hear someone if she's investigated that.
Okay.
Well, we looked at that because, of course, you're right, that has been an argument that has been made. We concluded that that was not a pivotal, not a crucial element in the story here. We do feel, however, that the push for home ownership that was promoted by the government, by regulators, and by the private sector was what contributed more to the creation of loans that really ended up trapping minorities and trapping first-time home buyers in houses that they could not afford. So we really do not lay it at the foot of the Community Reinvestment Act, but there was a sense that by pushing home ownership rates to include people who were not previously homeowners, that it really did lead to this, it sort of opened the door to these really toxic loans that were created to allow people who maybe couldn't afford quite as much house to buy that house.
Thank you. And if I may, just one more word, and you can comment or not as you feel. With regulation, it just seems to me in almost every area, the regulators will always be behind the people in the marketplace. And there may indeed be malfeasance, but it could also be just that they can't keep up with a fast-changing market like that.
Well, I think that that's an element, but what we found in our reporting was that it was more of a collegial, collaborative view held by the regulators rather than just being behind the eight ball. You know, yes, Wall Street is very creative, and they'll always come up with newfangled ideas and securities that then the regulators have to play catch-up about. But what we found was that throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s, there was a real sense that the regulators thought the banks could make their own decisions on capital, that they would be prudent, that they would never risk their entire operations you know, by being imprudent. And it really was a hand-in-glove almost relationship. So I would say that is more, I think, at play here than the behind the eight ball, but both are at work. But it really seemed disappointing how much the bank's regulators were ceding their responsibilities to the banks themselves.
Well, I want to thank the caller. And just to make the further point, it's remarkable, and it seems like it comes up again and again, how the regulators and the regulated, there seems like they're just all part of one big club. That, for example, the man who was Secretary of Treasury in the late 90s, Robert Rubin, before he became Secretary of the Treasury, he worked for Goldman Sachs. After that, he worked for Citigroup. Tim Geithner, who is the current Secretary of the Treasury, he was head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And you can find many of these kinds of examples where people move back and forth between business and government.
Absolutely. And it is a revolving door. I think we feel that it is spinning ever more quickly than it has been in the past, and that it is really contributing to a sense among the regulated entities that they can capture their regulators and really control them. And that was something that we felt Fannie Mae learned how to do early on and almost instructed others to do.
Yeah. Well, we will get to that. Let's talk to some other callers here. Next, somebody in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Absolutely happy to hear the comments made. You've answered all of the things that I presumed were true. That is that realistic people, bankers, and money managers were indeed somewhat couching the catch, you know. I've got two questions. Why is it that Nigeria is the only country that I have heard of that has found reason to find criminal charges against some wealthier peoples? And then a second question, which I think is even more important, is why is it that the bailout money that we have extended to our American, I don't have a kind word for them, have taken their money and put it into commodity speculation, which is a good reason for the increase in the price of our food and energy?
Well, as far as the second question is concerned, I mean, I think that what has disappointed many people is the bailout money that was supposed to go to the banks to enable them to lend money so that companies could grow, so that consumers could, you know, actually afford their lives, that could small businesses could increase their employment. That money has really just sort of sat in the bank's coffers. It has not been used to lend. And so, again, it's this perception that the government felt so strongly about saving the financial system that they bailed out the banks in the hopes that they would lend money, but they have not lent that money at all. Now, as far as the speculation in commodities, I think that is coming from, big investment pools that really can move markets because of their size. So it really is sort of a secondary factor. But absolutely, you know, the banks were sitting on the money. They weren't lending it. And so the fact that the government gave it to them with no strings attached, with no demands about what to do with it, was, I think, a disappointment. Mm.
Well, that let me just ask the question then. Why is it that they were sitting on the money and they were not lending it out?
Because they're concerned about their potential losses, additional losses creeping up onto their books. They have already taken big hits to their capital. They need to shore that capital up. And so the idea that the taxpayer was helping them to do so meant that they could keep that money, hang on to it, to cover future losses that might arise, and instead of turning around and lending it out. So the government should have known, it seems to me, that that would be the outcome, because this is a very, very big, big hole that we dug ourselves into.
We have somebody else. Next caller up, I believe, is in Effingham, line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. This seems to me to be a replay of Western Europe in the 1930s. Two other things, that consumerism, when it was converted from necessity to erotica, then the thing took off and peaks and falls. And there doesn't seem to be any cure for that, because capitalism is what it is. And if you might address, and I don't know if you know about it or not, I just heard about it lightly, that the U.S. capitalist bourgeois class have accumulated, people we don't even know about, $42 trillion and still possess that. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that figure and what it references, but I think the point that you're making about, you know, the people that have benefited from this crisis and have really not been held accountable is a serious factor. You know, we had an idea that we could all be a member of the ownership society. And, you know, that's a great and noble idea, but, you know, it really was perverted and kind of hijacked by these large institutions. And it really isn't home ownership when you have a loan that explodes in its interest rate, you know, 2-3 years after you take out the loan. It really isn't home ownership when you are you get a second loan so you can extract the equity that you've built up in your home so that when prices fall in real estate, you are now underwater. So these products that were created really for the benefit of the banks that made the loans really ended up hurting the American people. And my feeling is that one of the silver linings to this cloud may be that the consumerism may be curbed. It may fall, this desire to keep up with the Joneses, to have the newest Viking stove or whatever, you know, gadget or car or whatever that you want to have so that you feel good about yourself. I think that people are really questioning that because of this event, which was really epochal. This was a really large, devastating event, which I think might have some ramifications that, like the Great Depression did from the 1930s.
And well, again, it's certainly true that a lot of the people that were hurt here were middle class people. What's really sad, and I think it's something that you try to point out in the book, is that going back to this idea that we were trying to promote home ownership and make it possible for lower income people to have homes, those are the people that were the hurt the most.
Absolutely, they were unsophisticated, they were vulnerable. I think they were targeted and preyed upon by many lenders because they didn't know what they were doing and they didn't know enough to ask the questions. And, you know, so when they took out a loan that would have an exploding interest rate, they didn't really understand the risk. They didn't understand that, you know, maybe interest rates wouldn't be lower when they went to refinance, and so they couldn't be, and they would be locked into the loan at a rate of 9 or 10% when it started out at 2%. So, yeah, it really became a pernicious situation for just the very people that the government was professing that it wanted to help.
And were those loan adjustable rate mortgages like that, were they really sold on the promise that before the rate went up, people would be able to refinance?
Oh, yes. I heard that just over and over and over again. And this is what, you know, a mortgage salesman or a woman would say, oh, you know, you can always refinance, because the experience had been one of falling interest rates for so long. And, you know, so that was a compelling argument. Oh, okay, well, interest rates may fall and I'll be able to do it more cheaply in 2 years' time.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Gretchen Morgenson. She writes about business for the New York Times. We're talking about the book that she's co-authored about the financial collapse of recent years. Reckless Endangerment is the title of the book. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Solid, reliable reporting has made the PBS NewsHour one of the most trusted news programs on television. Executive editor Jim Lehrer and his team of senior correspondents, including Judy Woodruff, Ray Suarez, and Gwen Ifill, bring you compelling original reports, in-depth analysis, and newsmaker interviews from the field. Get the straightforward story about what's happening in your world. Watch the PBS NewsHour live each weeknight at 6 on WILL-TV.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program. As this conversation is pre-recorded, we're not taking phone calls today. This is Focus.
The guest in this hour, Gretchen Morgenson. She's business reporter for The New York Times, where she serves as assistant business and financial editor. She's the co-author, along with Joshua Rosner, of the recent book Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Times Books is the publisher. We have a number of callers. In fact, the lines are full. So again, we'll try to get everybody in. But once again, people can help us by trying to be brief. And we'll go on and talk next with someone in Piatone on our line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm a contractor, and actually I've had to go find something else to do in the meantime. But part of the problem is people, like you said, they allowed the door open for everybody and anybody to get a house without putting 20% down. Why? I disagree with that. I spent a lot of time. I put 20% down myself. When I bought everything that I bought, my house, I'm on my third house. I've always graduated up to the dream house, and it's like your guest said earlier. Everybody wanted to have it now to keep up with the Joneses instead of earning it, instead of taking some time and going the route that the rest of us smart thinkers did. They went the other way, and it cost them. And I don't know how many houses I've been into where they had no furniture, nothing. They couldn't afford the property taxes. They couldn't afford, you know, just the maintenance and the upkeep of the house. And, you know, to me, it was unresponsible for people like that. Just because they wanted something yesterday, you know, it's everybody's impatience. And I think that's the way the world operates nowadays. I don't think people are smart in the way of what they do, you know. I guess that's the reason why Kmart and Walmart and Target are, you know, people are going to them and spending money there more than they are the quality stuff anymore. They don't want quality stuff. They want everything and not be able to pay for it. I don't know. What's your comments? And I'll get off. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. This no down payment issue or 20% versus the 20% down payment issue, which, of course, was historically the requirement that most banks would levy on a borrower, that went by the boards. And one of the first entities to, you know, kind of push that off was Fannie Mae, which started talking about accepting loans that did not have a 20% down payment. It started to diminish. It went all the way down to, it went to 3% of a down payment. And then we sort of, that again opened the door to these silent second loans where you wouldn't have to put any money down. There were even loans that would cover your closing costs. So right off the bat, you're in the hole to the bank because your asset, you know, included your mortgage included the closing costs. So yeah, it was a again, this was part of the degradation of lending standards that was created by this homeownership push. So it really wasn't something that people, that consumers, that borrowers pushed for. They were offered these loans, and it began with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac being able to guarantee them, which encouraged lenders to make these kinds of loans. Now, there were people who took advantage of it who should never have done so. I'm not saying the borrower is without fault here. There is a lot of blame to go around. But the borrower could not have achieved that, could not have received that loan if you didn't have a lender willing to make it.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that there are people who could make the who would make the argument to say, getting people in a home, giving them a chance to start to build equity is not a bad thing, and that maybe if people were going to buy a modest home and looked like they had the means to make the payments, you know, maybe 10% downs would be okay. But you're putting a lot of, I know I'm putting a lot of qualifications on that.
Right. And the qualifications were sort of went out the window.
Yeah.
You know, you could make a loan to someone with a low down payment if you looked very closely at their past borrowing behavior, their job history, all that stuff sort of went by the boards because, again, it was about generating fees to the lender who could then pass the loan off to somebody else.
I want to make sure that we talk a little bit here about a little bit more about Fannie Mae, since this is something that you really have a particular emphasis on. And there's one individual here, really, who stands out, and that's James Johnson, who ran Fannie Mae in the 90s at a time when it was expanding. Fannie Mae made a lot of money. He made a lot of money. Do you think that he's deserving of some particular attention?
Well, this is a person who ran the company when it was changing from sort of a sleepy utility into a political powerhouse, into a lobbying powerhouse, into a company that actually was at the table when Congress was writing legislation in 1992 to make sure that the taxpayer would not have to bail out Fannie and Freddie. So this is a person who, according to all the people we talked to, was really an architect of this idea that a private corporation, in Fannie's case, a quasi-private corporation, could really create its own destiny if it really was able to neutralize all of its critics, if it was able to co-opt its regulator, if it was able to buy off Congress. So it was almost a template that Mr. Johnson used to create this political powerhouse where members of Congress would receive favors from Fannie Mae and would in turn protect the company from any kind of criticism or from any attempt to remove its special government subsidies and perquisites. So that's the reason we felt that this person was worthy of attention. And, you know, he has not received much attention. He is not a household name. And we also thought that that was important because he's still in great positions of power. He was Obama's veep vetter before he was elected. He was in charge of looking at all the vice presidential candidates until his sweetheart loans from Countrywide Financial sort of forced him to resign. But again, a person who was really behind the scenes a little bit, so we felt it was important for people to understand his role.
Yeah, all right. Other callers here. Next is Avon, Indiana, line one. Hello.
Good morning, folks.
Yes. Hi.
You have gone through, ma'am, and outlined, a lot of the people that have been involved with this gigantic ripoff. However, it's just a continuation of what's been going on and on and on for years. If I go to the bank and seek a loan, they want an insurance policy to cover their risk against me. Why don't we have the same requirements on the people that make these loans? When they step out of bounds, when they get carried away, the insurance policy is going to get collected. I mean, you look out in cattle country, the worst thing out there is rustling. They catch you, they want to string you up. And that is a very good deterrent, one of the best regulators around. Why don't we have this in the money game?
Well, let's get an answer here. Particularly, I think that, at some of the things that you mentioned, like, for example, the idea that some people think that the bank should actually have the money to cover their own losses one way or another, that has been discussed. I'm not sure that we've really done very much in that regard, though.
No, I mean, I love the idea of it being, like cattle rustling because, there are costs associated with risky behavior and with theft in other areas of the country and in other areas of business. But what we have seen, unfortunately, in this episode is that the government has been so desperate to, quote, stabilize the financial system that they have not pursued individuals who put the financial system at risk. They have not prosecuted any very high-level people who put the financial system at risk. Now, they will tell you that it's because maybe no crimes were committed, that maybe it was just stupidity But it is very difficult to believe that it was just a series of stupid errors that created this kind of a situation with trillions of losses. So I think it all is a part of this notion from Washington, from the center of Washington, that we must protect the financial system at all costs, and if that means not prosecuting individuals, then so be it.
Well, I thought, though, that at least some of the big Wall Street banks that were involved in taking these subprime mortgages and bundling them together and making these securities, these collateralized debt obligations, actually did go out and buy insurance policies to cover potential losses if those things went bad. But yet another problem here was the people that sold them the policies actually didn't really think that they might have to pay off.
Absolutely. They didn't have the necessary capital. They didn't have the reserves to pay off those claims. And then, David, you get a third layer of problem here, which is that if the loans were not appropriate, i.e., if you're a seller of loans and you say, look, they're all high-quality people, they all have FICO scores of over 750, they're all diversified, all of these elements that were supposed to be in these loans that made them considered high quality, if those were not actually the characteristics of these loans, then the insurers can step back and say, wait a minute, I insured something that was A, and you sold B, so I'm not going to pay that claim. Mm. So, you know, it's just a huge mess, and the litigation is going to go on and on for years. But the point is, I think that your previous caller is, you know, the actual participants have sort of, you know, escaped scrutiny and have moved off center stage and are enjoying the fruits of the ill-gotten gains.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the last caller. We're moving into about our last 10 minutes here. We'll go next to a caller in Belgium. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. I've heard your guests speak many different times on different media. And I'm wondering, I've broached this topic before with Mr. Inge's guest, and you know, during this same period of time, when these things were all going so bad, we were prosecuting 2-3 wars that we didn't pay for either. We didn't put the 20% up. We went to the Chinese or whoever and borrowed every penny for these wars that we've been prosecuting. The whole country is guilty of this from top to bottom.
Agree, 100%. This is a country that has to learn how to live within its means, and it is not doing so yet. The discussions about the debt ceiling, you know, are at least bringing the topic up for discussion. But you are absolutely 100% right. So many of our obligations are not even on the balance sheet of the United States of America, and so therefore not even in the mix, not even up for discussion about how we're going to pay for them. So I could not agree with you more.
All right. We'll go on again to another caller here. This would be line number three, somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Just briefly, the credit card industry never helped much either, you know, in terms of the loans. And, you know, it was like, and then you had to pay back and nobody paid back. But the main issue I want to talk about or have you talk about is that, okay, you know, this tremendous pressure on the consumer to consume being 70% of, you know, that drives the economy. What's going to be the answer there? I mean, the consumer, how's it going to be done? I mean, you know, in the past it's been driven because they've gone further and further in debt. So if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, I think it would be a good thing if we did not go further and further in debt. And I am hoping that many people take this learning experience to heart and live within their means, both from a government standpoint and an individual standpoint. I think that we're going to have to, but your question is well taken. Your point is well taken. This is a country that has historically been very, very reliant on consumerism and consumers. And I think that what we are going to have to do, unless wages go up, unless incomes go up, which they are not doing and have not for a very long time, we really are going to have to remake the economy into one in which the consumer is not such a large portion of gross domestic product. So that is a very, very arduous process and a very painful process. And I think, but I think that it's something that we have to go through. We can't go back to this notion that living on borrowed money and consuming on borrowed money is the answer to get our economy rolling again.
All right. Again, we'll go to another caller. And this is also, I believe, someone in Champaign. Yes, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. When they repealed the Glass-Steagall bill in the Clinton administration under Republican Congress, do you think that had anything to do with the fact that all of a sudden all the banks could become insurance companies, they could be investors, they could be anything and everything to get money?
Yes, the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999 was pivotal. It was crucial. It was a central part of this mess. Now, keep in mind that that law had been created in 1932, I believe, and it really did us well for 66 years. And it's unfortunate, but it was starting to be chipped away at in the 80s, in the 90s. You know, little by little, banks and financial institutions were allowed to combine, different kinds of businesses. But really, it was the full and total repeal in 1999 that kind of set the ball rolling and really opened the floodgates. And that really was, I think, a moment that is pivotal in this entire story. And, of course, the Secretary of the Treasury at that time was Bob Rubin, who then went to Citigroup, which was probably the most important company that was lobbying the most strenuously for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So, again, that's a moment that illustrates the revolving door between banking and Washington in, I think, a very telling way.
Who was the CEO of Citigroup at that time?
Well, Sandy Weill.
Right.
Who had built the company, oversaw the company at that time.
Now, it's like you say, he was one of the main lobbyists to get this thing repealed, so all of a sudden, you know, commercial banks could become investment banks and they could all sell insurance.
Absolutely. He was a real prime mover in that.
And, you know, until those commercial banks became, you know, also investment banks, they didn't have all the economic incentives to be, you know, low-down, underhanded people selling loans to people that shouldn't have loans.
Well, it was a way for them to really leverage their operations. And so, yes, I would agree. It was really a key moment.
Let me, I appreciate the caller. We'll get some others. We'll try to do it. Let me get in a quick question here. There has been in Washington some discussion of creating a new kind of agency, a financial consumer protection kind of agency. Mm-hmm. Where does that stand?
Well, that was required under Dodd-Frank, the legislation that was passed last summer to try to help us be certain we would not go through another one of these episodes. And so it's right now being it's sort of a battlefront between, again, the banks and the consumer groups, because I think there's some question about who's going to run it. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of banks that feel like that's extra regulation that they don't want, and they're very, very, strenuously arguing against it.
And that seems that at least there are some members in Congress who are on the side of the banks in
yes.
this.
Yes, as usual.
Let's see. We'll go to line number two. This is, again, somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. An earlier caller mentioned not paying for the two wars. Well, he also forgot about a couple other things. The Bush tax cuts in 2001, 2003, and then the Medicare drug plan. So now you got five things that weren't paid for. And what I'm curious about is all the conservatives right now screaming about living beyond their means. Where were they? Where were they when we were spending this money without accounting for it?
Well, you were, yeah.
Okay.
I'm just, we're getting really short on time. But yes, go ahead, sure.
Well, go ahead and respond.
Well, Ms. Morganson, can you respond, or do you have a response?
Well, you know, where were they? I mean, I think that there just isn't no appetite in Washington to tackle these big issues. Just none. You know, there are too many moneyed interests arguing on the other side of these things. and the actual people who want a sensible government that lives within its means have no voice.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I just find it curious, and so now they spent all the money, and now when we're on our knees trying to get back up, they're saying, you know, we can't help anybody. We can't help the people who are out of work, who are the worst unemployment since the Great Depression, say.
Right.
The worst economic situation. So in my humble opinion, you know, what they're intent on doing is not letting anything happen, at least until 2012, which Mitch McConnell and Jim DeMint have stated. You know, what's their main purpose? To make sure that Obama doesn't get reelected in 2012. Mm-hmm. Now, these are elected officials. They're supposed to be helping their citizens, not worrying about the next election. So thanks for the soap.
Well, okay. We appreciate the comment. We're just about at the point we're going to have to finish up. Maybe real quick, if you can give me about 30 seconds, what do you see in the future for Fannie Mae? Will there be big changes?
Well, of course, that's the issue that Congress is supposed to wrestle with this year. You know, Dodd-Frank did not address Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at all. And so, you know, the one thing that I would hope for is that we can have an honest discussion about the role that the government should or should not play in housing. You know, if we could separate housing finance from housing policy, I think that would be a good idea. But we really have to really understand what went wrong here if we are to really make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Our guest Gretchen Morgenson writes about business for the New York Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for her coverage of Wall Street. She is the co-author of the recent book Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon, published by Times Books. Ms. Morgenson, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Wonderful show.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at how futures are trading as we enter the final hours of trade for this Tuesday. Soybean futures, traders say, may be entering a phase in the coming days of range-bound as market participants will not likely have a whole lot of new fundamental information to trade on until the harvest begins and producers provide information about actual yields. Rains could still help soybean yields, at least for those pods which are on the plant, help them with filling. But the crop is ahead of schedule and is approaching the end of its key pod setting phase. So the expectation is that harvest beans could trade in a range between its recent highs and lows. It's somewhere around $16.88 a bushel and $15.50. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. We'll begin in that soybean pit where August, going off the board today at noon, is at $16.80, up 23 and 3 quarters. It's been as high today as $16.90. That would be an increase of 33 and 3 quarters. September at $16.24 and a half,